Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, as our guest on the program, we're going to have someone who's been on the show several times before, one of the leading television and radio journalists of the past 10 years and an author. Laura Flanders will be joining us today on Media Matters. But before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Free Press held a summit in Washington this week designed to deepen conversations about the future of journalism and the Internet. Free Press President Josh Silver set the tone for the event. He cautioned that we don't have the luxury of time when it comes to the failings of our media system.
We cannot wait until things reach disastrous proportions to realize that they are wrong. We must look at the facts and ourselves and summon the courage to advance the policies that will make our communication system, our economy, our information society, and our democracy work for everyone, not just the largest firms. This is not about the interests of the left or the interests of the right. This is about the public interest.
As part of his eloquent introduction to FCC Commissioner Mignon Clyburn, Joseph Torres of Free Press referenced Clyburn's outsider status coming into the agency and talked about the difficulty of working inside the Beltway.
Do many of us here remember what that was like when we moved to the city hoping that we can actually improve the lives of everyday citizens? But for too many of us, that hope soon faded because we saw firsthand. Once those curtains were pulled back, we saw how this town often operates. We saw how lawmakers and regulators were influenced by large corporations to support policies that undermine what's best for the public. We also learned that while the FCC is an independent government agency, it does not operate in some separate universe. It's often influenced by corporations and politics as well.
Commissioner Clyburn took the stage and spoke about the need for the agency to look beyond the Beltway for opinions and ideas. She wants the FCC to have regular contact with the people most impacted by proposed decisions. She also called for more public hearings on the proposed Comcast-NBC-Universal merger.
It is critical that we hear from people and speak with people about what is most important to them and engage with them on why we make the decisions we do. That two-way communication is essential to good governance. A great start down this path would be for the commission to hold public hearings on the proposed Comcast-NBCU merger outside of Washington, D.C.
Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota voiced his support for net neutrality at the summit. He had strong words for groups claiming that this basic internet protection was a government takeover of the internet.
The internet was begun by the federal government, and it was created and the architecture developed and the flowering of the internet was allowed to happen under rules that had the non-discrimination requirement right in the rules. So that always existed up until Chairman Powell decided, I don't want that to happen anymore. Our determination to recreate the non-discrimination rules is not an attempt at a government takeover of the internet. This allegation is another part of the big lie that so permeates public policy these days.
In a panel about social media, social justice, and the future of the internet, author Deanna Zant confronted Facebook's Andrew Noyes about privacy issues at the company.
In my utopian version of 2015 is that we're all, we have free and open platforms, that there isn't just one social network that owns our data and does whatever they want with it.
Whoa.
Just saying. Had to get it out there. Been working on a little campaign. Some bunch of people, you know, maybe upset with the whole privacy thing. Just saying. The summit also explored public media and how to build support for it politically and financially. To cap off the event, Jamu Green of the Women's Media Center gave the closing address. She called on everyone to help ensure women's voices are heard in the media, commercial and non-commercial alike.
Women have been the majority of college graduates for nearly a decade. And now we are earning the majority of advanced degrees. And yet, depending on the media outlet, we compose somewhere between 1 and 30% of sources and opinions featured in the news. But a lot of news outlets never even ask the questions of who makes it on air or how they serve diverse communities. But again, as the NPR study shows, this is not just a commercial media problem. Public media absolutely has a responsibility to embrace and correct this problem. Each of you here has a role to play. When you leave out half the population, you simply cannot tell the whole story.
To watch the videos, read some of the speeches, or find out more, go to freepress.net/summit.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is the host of Grit TV, the television program that can be seen on many satellite systems around the country, and the author of numerous books, including Blue Grit, someone known to many of our listeners and often requested from our listeners when they send in messages to myself or to the producer, Melissa Trentz. Our guest, none other than Laura Flanders. Laura, welcome to Media Matters.
Oh, great to be back with you, Bob.
Well, it's terrific to have you here. And since you were last on the air, which was a couple of years ago when we were talking about Blue Grit, you have launched this extraordinary television show. And I want you to talk a little bit about Grit TV, if you would. What was the idea behind it? You know, how can people find out more about it? Just a little bit about the background on the show.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Yeah, it's been quite a ride. I think as we were talking last time about Blue Grit, the book, I had just finished from basically a spell traveling around the country and writing about and reporting from some hotspots of progressive activity. I felt there was more going on in the country than met the media eye. And I think I was right. As the election of 2008 turned out, I wasn't the only one noticing that there was a kind of upsurge of progressive oomph out there. Barack Obama figured out how to plug into it in one way and get himself elected president. In 2008, I was focusing on the need to keep that progressive movement aware of itself and self-conscious, so that we wouldn't see the same dynamic play out as so often plays out, which is the election's over, people go home and wait for the president to screw up. Grit TV was really founded partly, initially, for that reason. Can we, as it were, keep our, not just hope alive, but our avenues of communication? And secondly, as I became more and more informed about the media moment that we're in, not just the political moment, but the media moment, I was excited by the possibilities.
And so how long has it been on the air now?
We launched on May 12th, 2008. So we're about to enter our third year.
And you were carried primarily on satellite systems, is that right?
Well, our first home was Free Speech TV and remains our primary carrier. Free Speech TV is a 24/7 commercial-free television network, one of the oldest and most widely seen on satellite television, Dish Network, channel 9415, I think, if I can get it right. If your listeners aren't aware, programs that are carried by Free Speech TV, maybe they're Free Speech TV supporters, those shows are all made available to community cable stations all around the country. So immediately we were on not just this many million strong satellite television channel, but also available to cable stations all around the country, and many started putting us on the air. This year, I'm excited to say that 2 years in, we have gotten picked up by several public television stations, one in Denver, one in Philadelphia. There are others that are interested. And Free Speech TV as a whole, partly I think because they had a injection of new programming, has been picked up by the DirecTV satellite service. So we're really we're packaging a show for television, for the web, and for satellite television. We're pretty much reaching all of those places, and now we're in a mode of, can we consolidate?
any idea how many people are watching one of the hourly shows? It's Monday through Friday, 1 hour long.
We used to be Monday through Thursday, one hour long, and we've now gone to Monday through Friday, but half an hour long, and that's a gesture, I think, to the appetite for easily shared video files.
Mm-hmm.
People want shorter stuff that they can send around to their pals and post on their Facebook pages, and that's just what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it hard, actually, to figure out exactly how many people are watching. And, you know, those satellite channels are very proprietary about their numbers. But we estimate it somewhere between 500,000 and 800,000 watching on an average evening. And that's not bad for an independent outlet. Let's not forget that, you know, Larry King on a good night is at the top end of that scale, and a lot of cable news is way down doing worse than that.
No, I think that's an extraordinary number. I think it's one of the real great accomplishments in independent media in the last 3 years has been the rise and emergence of grit TV.
Oh, I appreciate that.
How big a staff do you have, Laura Flanders?
Well, we have all our imaginary friends, and then there are really 8 full-time people and 2 part-time people. So that's it, to produce 5 half-hour shows a week that are getting seen by an enormous number of folks in all sorts of ways. I mean, I will say that we don't just have imaginary friends. We also have a collaborative of like-minded, progressive social justice groups, independent media outlets, independent journalists who meet with us. We hold open editorial meetings once a month on the first Friday of any month. If you're in New York City, you can come down to our office. You can join us by conference call, pitch your stories, give us ideas of what you've got coming up, books coming out, guests coming through town. It's our way of getting smarter about what's happening. We don't guarantee to cover anything, but we certainly do open up a dialogue, and we've found that's been very rich so far.
Our guest, Laura Flanders, the host of Grit TV, author of Blue Grit and other books, is joining us on the phone today. We're recording this program before going on air, about 9 days before going on air. So please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and let Laura Flanders and me do the yakking today. Laura, as you said already, when you wrote Blue Grit, it was to sort of demonstrate that there is actually a wellspring of progressive activism around the country, away from the coast, that's largely unreported on and unrecognized. And you wanted to sort of draw attention to this and see what was going on there. And the book, I think, was premised on a certain optimism about the course of the country that went against the prevailing pessimism of the middle part of the past decade. In recent times, I wondered, you know, if you've tempered your assessment in view of developments since January 2009. And let me add one more bit to that question, which is Chris Hedges, who's been a guest on the show several times, I know you're familiar with Chris's work, really argues one of the more pessimistic positions, that things are really pretty hopeless, that for a variety of reasons, the American people have pretty much been stupefied and are incapable, really, of progressive political action or any coherent political action at this stage of development. The society is so weighted down under illusions and commercialism and propaganda. What's your take on that argument, and what's your take on how your Blue Grit argument holds up 3 years later?
Well, wouldn't it be a bummer if I said that was my flash of optimism and now I'm in the dumps and we should all just go home?
It would be. In fact, I'd have to stop the interview and...
I won't deny that there are moments when I feel that way. When I look, for example, at somebody look at the crisis in Haiti and the coverage of Haiti. Most of it's awful. And then you have, at least for a moment there, you had Anderson Cooper speaking to celebrities. I mean, he found Sean Penn speaking, crying his heart out for attention, talking about imminent genocide from refugee camps outside Port-au-Prince. What happened to the ratings of CNN? Down, 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 while people like Glenn Beck continue to amass enormous audiences. That gets me depressed.
Yeah.
But as you and I know, we don't really have the luxury of getting depressed. And I think that those of us who've been in this job of changing the world for the better for a while know that it's not a day after tomorrow kind of prospect. I think Chris is right. We have some very major challenges. But most of those challenges I locate in two places, and really it's one place. which has to do with the disproportionate power of those with enormous amounts of money in our political process. And that political process is hugely determined by our means of communication. Nothing about how I see the problem in this country has changed. And it's not so different from the problem elsewhere. What's changed and what gives me optimism today, despite everything, is that, A, I think the problem is a little clearer than it used to be, and B, we have more means. It's not perfect. It's under threat. But we have more means than we ever had before of sounding the all-points bulletin, of sounding the alarm, of communicating with one another. Right now, I think our primary battle, this will be no surprise to you, has to be net neutrality, media, you know, justice. We have got to retain our ability to compete. We've got a better chance right this second than we've ever had in my business, in my time in this business of independent media. But if that's cut off, I think it will be a while before you can scrape me off the bottom of the dumps barrel.
Yeah, what are some of the media that you, independent media that hearten you, that's come along that you think have given progressive forces without a lot of property and wealth behind them, more access to the American people, more chance to influence politics?
Well, I think it's as much as new things as new collaboration. I think we have new collaborations so that a single story by somebody like Jeremy Scahill or something can actually get some energy behind it, because mm-hmm. there's a collaboration of media outlets from Alternet to Truthout to The Nation to Grit TV, Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio. We're figuring out, using social networking, Twittering, online video, you name it, how to tell a story not just once, but many times before we let it die and move on to the next one. It used to be it was a flash in the pan. You could get a great piece of reporting published somewhere, and that was it. You had a slim chance of getting some attention to the case that you were making. Today, I think it's a little bit different. And I also think, you know, sad to say, that news events have crystallize some facts in this country that we now, I think, have the means, or at least we have a better chance than we ever had, of drawing some connections between issues and between events and making a case for change. A couple of examples. I mean, this mm-hmm. week, as we're talking, and it's this season, really, we've seen, I don't know, how many tragedies caused by corporate malfeasance and disregard of safety violations, whether you're talking the Massey Energy mining disaster in West Virginia, claiming 29 lives, the worst mining disaster in over a decade, or the disastrous oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, British Petroleum and its leased rig, claiming the lives initially of 11, but how many more lives and livelihoods are going to be destroyed by that oil slick that, as we speak, is just now lapping up on the coast of the Gulf? Here you have two examples of multi-million, nay, billion-dollar companies. British Petroleum's profits were $6 billion this quarter. Simply reckoning into the cost of doing business human lives and the health of the planet. And I don't know, but I think we have more means than we used to say, wait a minute, the president came out right after there was a failed bomb attempt in Times Square, New York, and said, we need justice. I think we, many of us, came out and said, where's that word justice with relation to corporate malfeasance and corporate killers? And isn't it time that we actually started calculating the cost to ourselves and the planet of the kind of disregard that corporations have for anything that stands in their way of making a profit? Call me crazy, but I think post-financial crisis, post-economic crisis, and what we saw in Copenhagen, post what's happened so far this spring, I think the penny is beginning to drop, and we certainly have had more opportunity than we've had in a while with our independent media to force that dropping penny down the gullet.
Well, you mentioned the oil spill, Laura Flanders, and again, this show is airing more than a week after our interview, so things could change between our conversation today and going on air. But as you look at the media coverage of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, Do you think there's some angles in this story that are not being given sufficient attention? I mean, what's missing, or how would you reframe it if you were the news editor at some major news medium?
Well, there are lots of different ways to frame it. Immediately, what I would like to be doing is looking at similar rigs that are continuing to operate in the Gulf of Mexico and saying, why haven't they been shut down? The president got applause when he said we're going to hold off, you know, suspend our plans for future drilling. But there are very similar drilling rigs to the rig that exploded on April 20th, right now operating in the Gulf, in fact, closer to Florida. Where is the executive authority saying shut that thing down? That's the sense of urgency that I'm feeling at this moment, that there is more damage that can be prevented. But I think what I'm getting at is there is not just a question of environmental cleanup. There's a question of political cleanup that has to be asked right now. And that question has to be, how come most of the other oil developing countries in the world, Norway, Finland, Iceland, you name it, require a safeguard switch that our EPA doesn't require, corporate influence in Washington? How come we have let these corporations, and I'm thinking not just of BP, one of the biggest violators in this area, but also of people like Massey Energy, who, as we discovered, just dismissed safety violations as part of their operating costs for month after month after month. If corporations want to be deemed as people for the purpose of electioneering and campaign contributions, then we need to get very serious about corporate crime. And at what point can we say three strikes, you're out, someone's going to jail?
You know, on that point, and again, things might change in the next 10 days or 9 days, but one of the things that's most striking to me of the press coverage has been the reduced role in that exact issue, which is the safeguard device, the fail-safe device, and I think the name is the acoustic wire, but I'm not 100% certain of that, that the Norwegian rigs have out in the ocean. That means if something goes wrong, you can just basically flip a switch from land, and it shuts the well down automatically. That American wells used to have, apparently, but then in the last 10 years, that requirement was lifted on, by the Bush administration under pressure from the oil companies. To me, that ought to be the lead of every story. That should be the biggest national scandal imaginable.
I mean, again, when we see, you know, a ticking time bomb in Times Square, we say, big problem, terror. Let's use all our agencies of government to protect the national security and the quote-unquote homeland. We should look at persistent corporate violators as a similar kind of a threat. And you're right. I mean, the angle of power and politics is a piece of this picture that we keep on missing. And we've missed it over and over again. Even with this BP story, it turns out the Coast Guard was operating from BP headquarters. BP was denying or admitting environmentalists and others access to the airspace over the Deepwater Horizon rig. When did they get to control our airspace? And who's in charge here? I mean, one of the tragedies, of course, is, you know, what is going to happen to the people who are barely recovering from the busted levees after the flood of Katrina of 2005. But that story, too, was about corporate power. That story, too, was about violations when it came to corporations dredging the marshlands. And then, of course, the Army Corps of Engineers under-resourcing those levees. We've got to get serious about talking about power and politics. And the poor New Orleanian story, or the poor benighted Gulf Coast story, has got to give way to what are we actually going to do to change anything? Because, you know, from the mine lands, the coal mine fields of West Virginia, to the deep water rigs out there in the Gulf, I don't see any imminent change on the books there any more than I see it in the works around Wall Street. And at a certain point, I mean, you don't have to become hopeless to think, what's wrong with us that we don't demand more of our government, that it works for us, not these folks who are walking the halls of Congress with enormous lobbying power.
My guest today on Media Matters is Laura Flanders, who you've just been listening to. She's the host of Grit TV, which can be seen all over the country, but especially on satellite television. You can go online and download it as well, Grit TV. And this is a pre-recorded show, so sit back, relax, and let me do the talking with Laura for the next 45 minutes until the show's over. And we're talking about American politics, American journalism, world politics, world journalism. Laura Flanders, at the outset of the show, we talked about Blue Grit, your terrific book from 3 years ago, which chronicled sort of grassroots activism around the United States. And I think, as you said, it captured the sense of political momentum that was developing in the country then, that in many ways manifests itself in the election of Barack Obama as president in 2008. And now we are a year and a half into the Obama administration. And I think it's time to say, what's your take on what sort of administration this has been so far and what the Democrats have been like as the party in power in Washington?
Well, it's a good question, and I ask it of like my guests all the time. I will say one thing, which is the one of the reasons that I was interested in the Obama campaign and wrote about it to some extent for The Nation magazine was because I felt that it was, of all of the campaigns, particularly the primary campaigns, and I was talking mostly about the primary races, it was the one that seemed to me most likely to seed a new generation of grassroots activists with some organizing skills, resources, mailing lists, you name it. The point being that, you know, it's never presidents that change things. It's people. It's people power. And a presidential campaign that leaves some legacy of organization and communication and people with skills and experience, not to mention a victory under their belts, is really the best that we can hope for from presidential campaigns. Do things change in Washington? A little. It's what changes in the country that really makes a difference. So this time on, what I've been looking for during this administration is less, you know, policy from them than pressure from us. And I can't tell you how many people I brought onto the show in the wake of the election of 08, and what they would say was, we're going to keep this administration's feet to the fire. We're not going to sit back. It's not going to be like Clinton years. And yet, I have to say, what is this? 2 years later, the first people I've seen chain themselves to the White House fence were a couple of weeks ago, from when we're talking, when a bunch of uniform-wearing military service personnel chained themselves to the White House fence because they'd had enough talk about repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell and actually wanted some action. Now, that to me was great, but boy, it's been a long time coming, and is it going to signal a real change in progressive activism? I don't know, but you hear me. It's less about the president and more about us. He's the president. Has he done some good things? Sure, but on the critical stuff we needed addressing, corporate power in Washington, financial reform, housing reform, job creation, we needed him to come in and declare a government jobs program in the style of FDR to have been in keeping with the size of the population back in Roosevelt's day. If you're going to be consistent, that would have been a job creation scheme by the government of some 12 million jobs. That might have made a difference in our economy. It might have made a difference in politics, diminish the gap between rich and poor, create some buying power at the local level where people actually spend money in their local community. In the absence of that, all this tinkering around the edges of our economy is really just kind of rebalancing a very downward tilting ship. If we can't create some jobs, I mean, you must see it where you are, I see it where I am. I don't see how we move forward. And if we really think we can have an economy based on the ether of derivatives trading, the richest people in the world are getting rich not by making anything or hiring anybody, but betting on what happens to the T-bill next Tuesday, I think we're dreaming.
Well, there has been, speaking of dreaming, maybe nightmares, some of the big action politically since, even before President Obama assumed office, became president, it seemed like there were already strong protests from what now is known as the Tea Party or the Tea Bag movement against him and his legitimacy as president. Were you surprised by the Tea Party movement, and what's your take on it?
Well, I wasn't, you know, I have arguments with people about this all the time, but I wasn't surprised in the sense that we had seen many of the same horrendous signs and rhetoric and language used during the campaign. And part of my media critique of the election coverage was the sort of underreporting on the more extreme racist, anti-Obama, anti-change rhetoric coming out in the election campaign itself. It shouldn't have been a surprise that people were comparing Obama to Hitler in 2009. They were doing it in 2008 on the election campaign. Sarah Palin's rhetoric didn't really change from when she was running for vice president. And yet you did get this sense of that was that, and this is now this new thing that just developed. I think it was, A, predictable, and B, you know, we could have been prepared for it. But the frightening part to me was even I hadn't imagined it would be being organized by a television network,
mm-hmm.
that we would literally see the likes of Sean Hannity, you know, volunteering to help attract support for Tea Party candidates in elections, giving out free tickets at live shows to people who contribute to candidates. He had to back off from some of that stuff, but the use of the media in a partisan way did kind of hit me upside the face, not because we haven't seen partisan politics, but we haven't seen flat-out mobilizing by the right like that, even as they continue to rail against liberalism in the media, which, as you and I know, is a bunk.
Laura Flanders, speaking of Fox and speaking of sort of partisan politics, probably the flagship program in that regard on the Fox network for the last year has been the Glenn Beck Show.
Yeah.
Do you ever watch that show?
I don't. I should. I like to think of it as a satirical show. And I like to believe that it's really a Colbert in wolf's clothing or something. But I know it's real. I know it's true. It's just hard to believe that it's not a joke.
I think that's absolutely accurate analysis. That's certainly my response as well. Having been the punchline a couple times on it, it's far from funny. Our guest today, Laura Flanders. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, WILL AM 580. We recorded the show roughly a week or so before going on air, so please sit back, relax, let us do the talking. It seems that as you hit on with your assessment of the Tea Party, that the issue of race is a big issue in the United States and seems to be part, well, certainly not all, but part of what's going on with the really rabid attacks upon the Obama administration. And we've also seen this issue emerge in Arizona last week and the last couple of weeks with the passage of the new anti-immigration bill. I don't know what they call it officially. And what's your take on that Arizona law, and what does it mean to you?
Well, I think in both of the situations that you just described, and I think we had this conversation 2 years ago, if mainstream so-called America doesn't get it that it is only as secure as its most vulnerable members, I'm talking Democratic voters who don't happen to be people of color, if we don't get it that racism is going to be used to undermine our policy agendas in the same way that sexism has been, in the same way that homophobia has been, in the same way that, now you've got a kind of fear of immigrants being stoked by the right. I mean, this is, again, an ongoing challenge for many folks who thought, okay, well, now we've elected a president, an African-American president, a black president. We don't have to deal with racism anymore. And I will say, Bob, that I've also seen a rollback over the last few years. Maybe it's since, you know, a woman nearly won the nomination to run for president. I've seen a rollback of the commitment to gender parity, gender equality, even among progressives, among progressive organizations, even in this wonderful new independent media that we talk about. I can't tell you how many panels on the new media I still see 7 white guys. What? How is that possible? If we don't grapple with some of this stuff, we're just leaving enormous holes at the bottom of our barrel through which all of our hopes for justice and forward movement and advance kind of seep out. We've got a real challenge. And I was hoping, I think a lot of people were hoping, that Barack Obama would not run as much as he has from racial challenges in this country, the history of racism, the continuing impact of racism and white supremacy in this country, and that even if he was not going to grapple with it in his position as leader and inspirer and bully pulpit person, then let's have Joe Biden talk about it. Isn't that what he was there for? Isn't that part of what he was there for, to be the good white guy who cares about undermining white segregation? I mean, white separatism? I mean, the problem with the immigration fear is we all can see it. We can see how it's working to distract us from what we really need to be talking about: jobs, the environment, the economy. How are we going to keep this economy afloat? And what we're seeing is a finger-pointing session at the most vulnerable, and people without whom half of our state economies couldn't exist, and who give back more than they take in taxes and services. We all know that. And yet it's an easy, and I think it's an easy button to push. And I think in the same way, Bob, that you and I have talked before about the challenges when it comes to getting the dominant media to absorb a new idea or accept a new frame, well, so too there are challenges to get when it comes to getting them to name the old frames. And the old frame in this country that has been around since Reconstruction is that equality is somehow a threat to white people and to the white working class. And that somehow, if we give some justice over here, we'll take some justice from over there. And when you look at that poll, that survey of people that describe themselves as Tea Party members that was taken by the New York Times and CBS a few weeks back, that's what you saw. These were largely people who were, A, not that poor. They were more middle class and upper middle class in the income bracket. They were not that unhappy, even about their taxes. They thought the taxes that they paid were fair. What they were unhappy about was a sense that this president doesn't share their values and he's doing too much for those people of color, those women, those poor people, people not like them. That's an ancient feeling in this country, that somehow there's an us and a them, and if them get some, us will get less. Somehow we've got to deal with the fact that for most of us, our ship is kind of sinking. And we're kind of thinking all together. There's a little elite that are making out, and you see their pictures once in a while, like the New York Times business front page that had the 25 mugshots of the richest hedge fund owners in the country, earned over $1 billion on average each last year. The recession for some has not been a recession for all, but it has for most of us. And this divide and distract strategy is the oldest tactic in the book.
You know, as I hear you talk, Laura Flanders, I'm reminded of comments that others have made in the last year or two when they've laid out the facts about the economic inequality and corruption of the United States and the long-term nature of it, that it's not just a blip in the screen, but it's part of a long process, that this is a country that maybe is on the way down, that its best days are in the rearview mirror, and that's just the course that this country is on. Is that where we're going, barring some dramatic changes?
Well, I don't know whether we're going. I don't know how we keep going down while everyone else is going down as well. I mean, there are certainly countries that maybe the future is theirs. I mean, China, for sure. India, probably, vis-a-vis our own economy. I think the writing is on the wall. Vis-a-vis Europe, Europe's in miserable shape and about to get worse. You've seen what's been happening in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
The European Union is now saying the UK has a worse balance of payments, bigger deficit than any other country in the European Union. And you know what is about to hit the fan right there, forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
The question of, you know, how are we doing as a nation is an interesting one, only in the sense to me that so much of our policy is premised on the notion that we are special and that we have special rights,
mm-hmm.
special rights as a country to invade other places, to step in when there's a problem, to protect the world, to be the green market, or what do we say, the supermarket to the world.
the city on the hill.
That's right. Perhaps if we did begin to see ourselves in a more realistic light, it might change the way we treat other nations. So without wanting to celebrate the downward or the decline of anybody's actual individual livelihood or communities, because we wouldn't want to do that, there is maybe a salutary aspect to, American power isn't invincible after all, and all those weapons we've been compiling all this time, they didn't save us from this.
You know, it seems that at this point it's appropriate to say that were John McCain elected president rather than Barack Obama in 2008, and were John McCain to have pursued the exact same policy in Afghanistan and Iraq as President Obama has pursued, especially the surge in Afghanistan, that there would be a lot more talk about this by us probably on the show already,
yeah.
And certainly in what's called the liberal or progressive blogosphere. What's your take on this? It seems like, you know, the United States has now entered a zone almost like out of 1984 where we're fighting these sort of permanent wars. No one really understands why. That are going on forever. They go on some like Bleak House out of Dickens for generations.
Yeah.
What does it say that we're in this position?
Well, it's a good question, Bob, and I don't have a good answer for it, frankly. I mean, I think it's partly, again, the choices of our media. They say it's their finances. I think it's their choices. Where are they going to station people? What stories are they going to keep on the front burner? They haven't spared any expense to bring us the latest Sandra Bullock story, but you're right. Where is the reporting from Iraq? We had a guy detained in New York City recently, actually detained in Connecticut, Pakistani, who allegedly wanted to plant a bomb. I'd like some reporting on whether that has any relationship to the bombing the U.S. has been doing of the Pakistani border areas with Afghanistan, claiming, you know, scores of civilian lives in the name of trying to wipe out terrorism using pilotless drones. Is there a relationship there? Maybe. I mean, I think that our reporting has a big, big, plays a big, big part in our sense of urgency. But I will say, you know, I think there's a big responsibility for any one of us to know what is happening in their community. And you don't actually have to rely on CBS News or ABC or any major news network to tell you that there are vets in your community, there's a war being waged on poor people where you live, they're being disproportionately targeted for deployment, for recruiting and deployment, and you don't have to live in ignorance about all of this or just blame the media. You can go to your local high school, as so many parents are all across the country, and try to stop the recruiters. You can work with people when they come home. Just listen to their stories, hear what they have to say. I'm afraid that we are, again, considering our politics as judging our politicians. When, if the Vietnam War was any lesson, it wasn't about lobbying politicians to do something differently. It was about trying to stymie, to gum up the wheels of the machine, as Mario Savio said. It was about trying to actually figure out the role we could play in stopping business as usual. And I think we're falling down on the job.
Our guest, Laura Flanders, you've just been listening to. She's the host of Grit TV, the author of Blue Grit. She's been a guest before, and I hope will be many times again. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show, so sit back, relax, let us do the talking for the balance of the program. And, you know, when I was traveling around the country in the first half of this year, the first several months with John Nichols flogging our new book, one of the things that was striking to me was how demoralized Obama supporters were, who'd be in our audience, and just demoralized in general. And much of it seemed to deal with the health care bill, the inability to get a single payer or at least a public option through despite the popular support for dramatic reform of the health care situation in the United States. And they finally did get a bill through. And I know you covered this story quite a bit. What is your take of what bill finally came through? Is it a victory or is it not?
Well, I'm with you. I mean, and that was one of the reasons that we tried to, that we started Grit TV, was the sense of a sort of impending gloom of disappointment descending on Obama supporters. Have we managed to kind of evade that descending cloud? No, I'm afraid we didn't. But at least we have a place where we can talk about it. And I think the healthcare debate was the first one that really hit people. That and the bank bailout. People wanted to see a change in direction from the Bush administration, and they didn't see enough of one. Now, again, I'm not one that believes that we should write people off and then sit back and be upset. I think that we have to continue to be active. And one of the frustrating things of the healthcare debate was not just how quickly Obama caved, but how quickly so many people caved, giving up on their hopes of a public option, and I mean of a national healthcare system, of a non-profit universal system, and instead getting into these sort of arcane fights about the public option. Did we come some distance at the end of the day? I don't know. I weigh it up very, very carefully whether or not to just sort of stonewall the bill altogether in my reporting and my coverage and commentary. And I got it from everyone. No, let's move forward, let's move forward. And I didn't feel it was my role as host to say that those hopes were all bunk. I did say, and I continue to say, that we're going to be sold healthcare reform as reform that does nothing really except deliver more of us into the hands of private health insurers. Are there some fixes in the on the books now? I guess so. Some laws against gender discrimination, some sense that there is a responsibility as a society to make sure that everyone has health insurance. But to make sure that we can all pay for it, I don't see how we can have a forceful regulatory body clamming, setting some limits on corporate profits in healthcare when that whole bureaucracy is underwritten by a private insurance company and Pfizer pharmaceutical company campaign contributions. I just don't see it. They're already fighting the agency that is supposed to cap profits for the private insurers. Who's fighting them? Multi-gazillion dollar private insurance companies. How can we compete with that? So I wanted a national healthcare system. I think I would have called that reform. What's this? It's some more tinkering with our private healthcare system. The fear is when this doesn't work, or if this doesn't work, and we should say 32 million new people getting access to the possibility of coverage isn't a bad thing, it's a good thing. But we need to stand firm that this is not the reform that we had in mind. This is not change that we voted for. This is tinkering with an existing system, and maybe we underestimated the power of the corporations and the weakness of the Democrats in office. But I think we have every right to say, okay, well, if you're glad that we didn't just, you know, protest your every move, then we demand that you continue to collect accurate information on who's being covered, what they're being charged, what kind of profits these companies are making, and whether, in fact, as a nation, we're getting any healthier.
Laura Flanders, it begs the question when you talk about health care and how the bill played out to talk about the financial reforms that are now currently being debated in Congress. When I listen to you, it seemed like we're talking about almost the same equation for that crisis.
Well, I really recommend people checking out Grit TV, where you can go find us online, see the archives, grittv.org, anywhere you are. You can subscribe to the video podcast if you want, and you get it delivered to your podcast directory every day. But I had the opportunity of interviewing Alex Gibney and Bob Ney about their new film, Casino Jack, about Jack Abramoff. Mm-hmm. And I had the same feeling then, like watching this film about the lobbyist scandal of 2006 of the Republican administration, the one that took down Tom DeLay and sent Jack Abramoff to jail. And Bob Ney, the only politician to go to jail over any of it, was a six-term House member from Eastern Ohio who ended up serving, I think it was 17 months in a West Virginia prison. The scandal that they were documenting in the film that's just been released, Casino Jack, they say, you know, the numbers pale in comparison to the amount of money that was spent lobbying around health care, that is continuing to be spent lobbying around financial reform. And in the same sense as you just said it, you know, I watched this film of Congress people wagging their fingers at Abramoff's clients, who they themselves had received money from those same clients and those same lobbyists. Well, so too with financial reform. You look at, you know, even good people like Carl Levin, and you think, here you are in these hearings around financial reform, wagging your finger at the head of Goldman Sachs, but you were there in office when the administration voted to make the changes in financial regulations under Clinton that made more or less everything that Goldman Sachs did legal. Not everything, I don't think, but most of it. Again, where's the self-consciousness that our politicians played a role in setting things up this way? I mean, that goes back to where we began with our media. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not just, ooh, scandal after scandal after scandal. This is a consistent pattern of policymaking for a reason. And I would say at least one part of that reason is greed and our private, privatized election system that has only gotten a whole lot more privatized with that Citizens United decision at the Supreme Court. So you're right, where they're talking healthcare, financial reform, environmental regulations in the Gulf, safety regulations in the mines, it's the same power dynamic at work, and somehow that's the one piece that doesn't get the consistent play in the coverage that it needs, maybe because the people bringing us our news are part of it.
Alex Gibney, I should add, who made the film Casino Jack, will be a guest here on Media Matters in June. So listeners, stay tuned. We'll have Alex with us to talk about this new film. You know, when I hear you talk, Laura Flanders, the thing that jumps out to me, and I know I'll have people asking me, and I get the question a lot too, is, you know, are there any politicians at all in elected office who we can look to with some sense that they are people of integrity and vision who are committed to democratic values? Are there people that you cover now say, boy, that person's, I like them. They really seem to have it. I mean, I respect them, not like in a personal sense, but respect them as...
Yeah,
as...
I mean, again, you know, you look at somebody like Claire McCaskill when she was questioning Lloyd Blankfein, and remember, you know, what some of these folks have said during the heights of the crises that we've looked at in the last few months. You know, the congressman who gets up and says, I don't want those who are being evicted in my home state. I think it was Senator Cantor saying, you know, occupy your houses. Don't agree to be evicted. You have the right until they can bring the papers. There are some who are clearly trying to stand up and say, resist, but I don't think it's a matter of individual politicians. They get into office, and this is what they're up against. They are having to raise at least $20,000, I would think, a week at this point to stay in office. They barely have time to pay attention to policy, let alone the phone calls coming from their constituents, because if they're doing as much fundraising as that, hey, I know what it's like to try to fundraise for a small independent media project. It does take up half your time. It takes up more than half theirs, it seems to me. And this is no way to expect good people to get good work done on our behalf.
Laura Flanders, you've only got like 5 minutes or so left. And the subject you raised earlier, I've been wanting to talk to you about, and this is a good time to turn to it. One of the beats that you've covered, I think, for as long as I've known you, going back to the mid-1990s, has been sexism and homophobia in the news media, in our culture, in our politics. You alluded to it earlier. And a couple of weeks ago, we had as our guest on the program Susan Douglas, who has a new book out called Enlightened Sexism. I don't know if you had a chance to see
it. No, I haven't, but I'm glad to know about it.
Yeah, and Susan Douglas makes an argument that there, you know, we have a paradox in the United States today where, you know, in many respects, women are further along in terms of economic parity and political parity than they've been in our history, especially if you look at younger women. Yet at the same time, the sort of commercial culture in which young people are immersed in today is in certain ways far more sexist than it was 15 or 20 years ago. I mean, it's a very bizarre world we're living in. She calls it enlightened sexism. And that's a different world than the one you're talking about necessarily, where you're going to political meetings about the blogosphere. But you live in this planet, in this world. I wonder what your take is on that argument.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, it's no question. We've got women earning a larger proportion of a man's wage now than in many, many years, I think, because men's wages have so shrunk. Not good news necessarily, but with respect to parity, maybe a step to some kind of forward. I'll tell you one of the most interesting things, one of the most interesting conversations I had recently that touched on these issues, and maybe it gets back to our kind of shallow understanding of what feminism is and sexism is and what the study of either one of these things or gender in our society is all about. I talked with Raj Patel about his book, The Value of Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
fabulous book about how we undervalue what's important and overvalue what should be cheap. And he talked about the roots of some of this in our culture, which I think what you're getting at. I think on a kind of cultural level, we have more sexism than ever. And as he was talking about what's valued and what isn't and how we've got it sort of flipped on its head, I was thinking about how the root value of the first sort of exchange that we know in our lives sets us on this dreadful path of not having any sense of what costs anything and should be worth anything. And I'm thinking, of course, of, you know, the no money that we pay to mothers and parents and the undervaluing of caring and family creation and house and homekeeping. It's sort of in the same way that we underpay still, whether they're men or women, people that work with young children, people that work with old people. We underpay teachers. We overpay corporate executives. It sets in early that we disregard a certain kind of work that's associated mostly with a certain kind of person. And I thought that was it reminded me that I think our study of sexism in society needs to get much deeper. It's been sold to us as all about, can women get the same job as men? How many have those jobs? How many female faces do you see here versus how many male faces? But it's not really about bean counting any more than fighting racism is about bean counting. It's about what those differences have done to our power structure and how they've set us up to think of us in a certain kind of way about sort of entitled supremacy, whether it's racial supremacy or gender supremacy. We're taught that it's right that certain people just somehow get more, have better, are more valuable. And that does us in, whether we're men or women, rich or poor. Well, I guess it helps if you're very rich. It doesn't do us all in equally, it's true. But it's a way of looking at these isms that our media studiously ignore. And we saw it play out in the election campaign. We had, you know, the first anti-racist, post-feminist election campaign and lots of features about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. But they were only about those two people. They weren't about the power structures undergirding them, which I don't think changed during the election campaign. If anything, they kind of exacerbated, as we're seeing now playing out around the Tea Party mobilizations. You've got sexism of one kind, I think sort of favoring Palin in a certain way, and racism, of course, of a very obvious kind, with its, you know, its sights set on taking down a symbol of change. Whether or not he's really about change at all is another matter. I'd love to read Susan's book, but I think when we think about sexism, we've got to get away from purely the personal experience and look much more deeply, as you suggest, at the kind of cultural, social experience and the price we pay for it.
Laura Flanders, you've only got about a minute left, so I'm going to do something really awful that no self-respecting host should ever do to a guest. I'm going to ask you a question that requires a much longer answer than a minute, which is that, you know, given what you've been saying, the thing that jumps out to me is, given the state of our economy and the state of this country and the state of the world, at what point do Americans resurrect a term that has been banished to another world, socialism, and start talking about maybe we have to rethink the whole way we organize this economy?
At what point? At this point, of course, Bob. That's a short answer to your last
question. Yeah, that is a short answer.
At what point do we do that? We do it right now. I mean, everything we've talked about, power relations, all of it, what inhibits our ability to have an honest conversation about any of it is we're still terrified of red baiting. We're still terrified of anti-communism. We've got to just move on and realize that you don't have to be a socialist to be tagged as one by, you know, the Glenn Becks of the world. You barely have to put your head above the parapet for that to happen. So you might as well go the whole way and let's talk about how we structure our society and whether there are some other choices out there, maybe things we haven't seen yet.
Laura Flanders, we just have to wrap up now. If people want to follow Grit TV and they want to follow your work, where's the best place to go if they don't have access?
Best place to go, they go to the web, grittv.org. You can sign up for the video podcast, find out where we broadcast, and if you want to follow us on Twitter or Facebook, we're there too.
Laura Flanders, thank you so much for taking time from your schedule to join us today. It's been
great
having
you.
I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you all for listening to Media Matters. We'll be back 1 week from today. Have a great week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, cloudy today with a 50% chance of showers, the high 65. Showers are likely tonight with a low of 52. Showers are likely on Monday with a high of 66 degrees, and Monday night a 50% chance of rain with a low of 53. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.